Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who were they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 10. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician and podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Gary.
Hello. What you won't have heard, listeners, is it just took me three attempts to say the word music history. I kept on saying music mystery or something daft.
You might as well have just left it in rather than edit it out. I just told everyone.
It's the mystery. It's the Husic mystery.
Peek behind the curtain.
Yes. And that's what it's going to be a bit like this episode, because it's not a proper episode. But don't switch off.
Oh, dear. No, this is starting very badly.
It's a bit of a bonus episode. We used to do them, didn't we? We used to kind of in the first series.
We found something else to talk about sort of every 10 regular episodes, didn't we?
And we thought this time it'd be better to wait till we'd rounded up a couple of years. So we've just finished with 1961. And we will be embarking upon 1962 next week.
Forthwith.
But as I think we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, I suddenly got interested in what the albums were looking like. So we're going to talk a bit about that, amongst other things, aren't we, Paul?
We are.
Yes. But and it's all a bit more freeform and a bit more freestyle, so you'll hear a lot more than normal.
Not from me, you won't.
Okay.
I'm going to be bang on.
Okay, well, you're the consummate professional, aren't you, Paul?
I make notes.
Yes, well, Paul's made notes. That's my way of saying I haven't made notes. But hey, we're here, so let me do some of the usual stuff. Please keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort, or email us at bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And please also like and review and subscribe to the show. We've had a couple of reviews, and thank you very much to the people who put them in. They were lovely. Please consider dropping by any links that I put in the episode description.
Or the link tree,
which is on the social media kind of bios and all that stuff, which has links to all sorts of stuff. So, Paul, let's do a ad hoc Beatles news section, because there's quite a lot of Beatles things just to talk about in general, isn't there?
There is, and I'll start by getting out of the way what is breaking news today as we record this, but won't be, obviously, by the time it comes out. It's the 22nd of February today, and it's quite sad news. Is that we've lost another quarryman.
Yes.
John Dufflow has passed away at the age of 81. And his place in the Quarrymen is quite a unique one. He was a piano player, which is, I often think about this with a skiffle group or whatever. A lot of what skiffle was sort of portability, access, DIY, sort of, you know, battered old guitars, banjos that were lying around, T-chest basses, all that sort of stuff. Stuff you could pick up and move. You can't really do that with a piano. But a piano is a great instrument for putting into a band, because it enables you to do all sorts of stuff, rhythm, bass, without having all the other bits and bobs. But so I often think about that. But he was with the Quarrymen for a little while, long enough indeed to play on That'll Be the Day and In Spite of All the Danger.
Yes.
So he's on that recording, which gives him a very special place in Beatles history, given that that has been issued, you know, on the anthology and all that sort of stuff. And he was, of course, the guy. They passed around the disc that they made in Percy Phillips' recording studio, and someone had it for a couple of weeks, someone else had it for a couple of weeks, and then, as Paul McCartney said, and then John got it, and he had it for 25 years, basically, until McCartney bought it off him for plenty of money.
Yeah.
And and later on he went back and rejoined the Quarrymen as they did their stuff in the 90s and things like that. And so that's a sad loss. That's another, you know, not a name that's much thought of in Beatles history, and certainly not to the layman. But John Dufflow, really, really key person in those early days. He's on a recording of the nascent Beatles, the pre-Beatles, proto-Beatles, the Quarrymen, which is brilliant. So rest in peace to John.
Yes, our condolences to his family and anyone who knows him. And it's always a shame to lose anyone from the legend, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's everyone's a piece of the jigsaw puzzle, and it is not a complete picture without any one of those pieces.
And talking about the legend, Paul. Would that be
the legend?
The legend, the Beatles legend in general. Would that be a good segue into some of the other news that's being bandied around this week?
Well, I suppose this week's big news is huge, really. Yeah. Actually, when you take a step back from the sort of instant reaction social media world of this.
Yeah.
Officially sanctioned by Apple, music and life rights granted, four film biopic series to be directed by Sam Mendes coming in 2027.
Wow.
Which seems...
not long.
Not long away for four films, yeah. Especially as it seems to imply that they haven't been written yet.
Right.
But that's big news. In the world of biopics, there is this distinction between sort of official, semi-official, not official at all.
Yeah.
This is about as official as it could be for probably the most important subject for a biopic there could be, certainly in music anyway.
Yeah.
It's big news. It's really big news. And it's going to put lots of people on edge because, you know, the Beatles mean so much to us all and we all see them in different ways and we all have our own feelings about them, our own loves and reasons why we love them and And there's always a thing with an officially sanctioned project is, well, are they going to clean up the story? What's going to be?
Well, yeah.
Who's got the veto?
Yeah.
You know, for any, is there one or have they said, no, you just do what you do. But yeah, officially, that's what's amazing. Life rights and music rights, which is usually what hampers a good biopic, is not getting those.
Well, yes. And like you say, it could go both ways. I haven't thought of it like that with being officially sanctioned. Not having the official stamp could maybe meant they could have got away with some more stuff, but it depends if they're going to back away from the kind of process and just say whatever it is, you know, whatever comes out of this comes out of it. I mean, when I've many a time spoken about my desire to see it serialized into a big series, a big drama series, which is the closest we're going to get to that, I think. And
yeah,
the comparison people make is like, what, like a Beatles Crown? Like the Crown, but
that
with the
Beatles.
That
was our pal Alan said, like the Crown for the Beatles,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, my wife said the same thing as well when I've talked about it. And it's like, exactly that, yeah. Take the eras, make a season out of them, and make sure there's enough episodes in there to get everybody's story, that you haven't got just one focus, one era, one, you know, weave in and out of it, all the satellite stories, you know, and that kind of thing. But like with the Crown, I think that kind of upset the royals as much as it did kind of, you know, build their profile in some ways, didn't it? There was controversial stuff
boo-hoo.
In there. Well, exactly. But taking that to the, you know, is there going to be stuff?
This is it. I mean, there's definitely things in the Beatles story that you wouldn't put out as your introduction to the Beatles film.
No.
So it can't be that. What I think is going to be amazing, hopefully, is this idea of four perspectives on the same story.
Yeah.
But the question is, how much do they do it? I mean, I kept saying it's like a Beatles Rashomon, which is that Kurosawa film where it's the same story told from different perspectives. Which is a fantastic film, obviously very influential. And it's obviously not going to be that, really. It's not going to be like we see Ringo coming into the studio on one day of Sgt. Pepper, but we also have another film where we see Paul doing the same thing, but Ringo's doing his thing in the background. You know, I don't know what it's going to be. This is a thing. Is it going to be...
they're not going to want the same beats.
1960 to 1970, you know.
Yeah. They're not... is it going to be Birth to Death, you know, for those of them who have died, obviously? Is it going to be Birth to Breakup of the Beatles? They're not going to want the same beats in every film, just from a different perspective.
Find the focus? Like, sorry, Gary, just to interrupt while you're just saying it. Like, so with the George one, are they going to focus on weighting it towards him pulling the spiritual influence in from India?
Yeah.
And the spiritual and musical influence from there? You know, he had a particular role. He was the one who brought that in and they followed along with him. by group decision.
Yeah.
Is it going to be... But then you have to think, well, what's the focus then for Paul or John? You know, it's...
Well, yeah. And are they going to...
And do you take Ringo as the new... Tell a story of being a newcomer to a group, you know?
It's a lot to cover. Even four films doesn't feel enough.
Not
when you're going to try and take them from an individual Beatles perspective. Although that does excite me, that slant on it, because it means that they can kind of carve up the story and maybe assign it to the most appropriate Beatle to get the most dramatic viewpoint on that thing that was happening at the time. So you don't just get the same things told four times slightly differently. You'll get everything told once from the most appropriate Beatles for the narrative. So yeah. And maybe they'll have to just divvy them out a little bit when it comes to... It'll be a heck of a writer's room job.
Oh, flipping heck.
How are they going to go about it?
What a responsibility that would be. Especially if it has to then bounce back and forward to Apple for approval.
Well, that's where I think the project might come undone. If they don't just say, you're doing it now, you're doing it, that's fine. If they're going to want, you know...
It's the fact that they've announced it through all the official channels. Mm. I mean, they've announced things before and they've not come to pass. Like, oh, Get Back's coming out by Peter Jackson. Oh, and we're also going to remaster and re-release the original Let It Be film to accompany it. Well, that's just gone quietly off somewhere. And like the 8 Days a Week documentary, I think they originally intended that to be something completely different to what it ended up being.
Right. The Ron Howard one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful film. But it's this, we don't know. There's just too many unknowns with this to say. I mean, I can understand why they've got a director like Sam Mendes there. His big name, big...
What's his kind of credentials then? I mean, I know the name. Well, what his big hitters are.
He did Skyfall and Spectre in the Bond franchise. Directed American Beauty years ago. Did 1917 recently as well.
Oh, I like 1917. Of course he did, yes.
Yeah, but he's also a very high-powered producer in the world of film. So he's got the industry heft.
The clout.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I know the social media has gone straight down there. Who's going to play them? But I think the idea should just be that you shouldn't really know, because unless it just so happens to be someone...
Oh, I hate... Yeah.
Unless it so happens that there's someone already quite well known who just happens to play to be a really good kind of fit for that role, it needs to be someone who's just auditions well from whatever pool of actors are out there. It's no
point. I hate speculation on casting. Yeah. It drives me at the wall, because everyone just goes to the... Oh, who are the famous people I can think of is basically what happens with casting.
Yeah.
It's like, the next Bond is going to be Idris Elba. It says, well, think of someone else.
Yeah, I'd be worried if I knew who any of them are going to be, because they're going to be... Yeah. I mean, are they going to do something where they try and age the same character, if they do, you know, although they don't age that much in 10 years, so...
But not if they just choose the main body of the story, but if they choose to talk about the formation of the band.
Yeah, exactly,
you know, you've got to have someone who can make an effective teenager.
There's so much to think about. It must be... They're going to have to be really clear with their parameters for this, because it's not going to work otherwise. I mean, you don't want to retell Nowhere Boy, for a start. There's no point, really. If you're going to do... kind of early life, and you fill half your film with that, it feels
it's
a context.
Yeah, it's been done.
Yeah, it's been done, and it's context that you could get across, maybe in flashback or dialogue, but it wouldn't make the main heft of the film, would it? It would be...
No, I mean, if you look at what Beatles biopics have existed, basically it's the pre-fame story, or it's the post Beatles story.
Yeah, but I want the bit in the middle.
They haven't done the bit in the middle, so that's what we need.
Because those just assume, and that's part of the naivety of the story when you're younger. I haven't watched whatever it is, the Backbeat Beatles or whatever, Backbeat and whatever it is.
Backbeat, Birth of the Beatles.
Birth of the Beatles. I haven't watched them for years, but in my mind, when I had watched them, it was a bit like all the interesting stuff happened and then they became the Beatles and it was all sorted from them. But that's not... The best bit of the story is really from there, isn't it? Especially for us fans, about how their careers develop and how they develop and all the things that happen to them on that journey.
So, it'd be interesting, especially as we're still waiting news on when Midas Man, the Brian Epstein story, is coming out.
Of course,
That's been in well, it seems like to an outsider, development hell for a few years. And that's, you know, that's going to be an interesting thing that'll come out with the Beatles in it in the presumably this year, but I don't know. I mean, that's not official or anything like that. That's not an Apple project.
And of course, Paul, let's not forget, we'll be able to gauge all of these projects by the success of the Beatles' appearance in the upcoming series of Doctor Who.
Oh, dear.
Well, which I'm sure will in no way at all completely annoy and frustrate anyone who knows anything about the Beatles.
I love Doctor Who and I love the Beatles. I am very, very worried.
Yeah. Just the tiny little snippet from the clips of someone already pointed out the...
I could talk about biopics forever. I have mentioned it many times. It was my dissertation subject when I did my master's, music biopics specifically. And there's such a range of approaches and quality.
Yeah. I'm excited, but I still think the longer form, maybe this would be the start of them writing the script out and going, listen, we can't tell this in this way. What we need is a Crown style, era by era series that enables us to spend time with each character as and when needed. And, you know, you want to focus on Brian Epstein episode, you give a focus on Brian Epstein episode.
Epstein episode.
Or maybe two. You don't have to kind of like shoo him in or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I do worry about
have a George Martin episode that kind of gets
him. Yeah, I worry about the what they might consider ancillary characters.
Yeah.
You know, even in those earlier ones, Brian and George get short shrift.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
You know, they're just sort of introduced as important people, which they are, obviously very, very important people, but their stories of how they got to meet
Neil,
and intersect and,
you know,
Neil and Mal and...
You can almost tell every person's story and it will all connect together.
That's the thing. You know, people have been mocking up these, you know, when Marvel announced the next phase of films, they put out these graphics that says such and such 2024, and such 2025, and it's all the logos and things. People have been mocking up ones like that. It starts out with John Paul, George, Ringo, and then it's like Mal, you know, and the Quarrymen, you know, like the Beatles cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Which is very good.
The BCU.
But all we can do at the moment is sit and wait for more news and hope the internet doesn't explode the day someone says, and the person playing Paul McCartney is.
Right. Well, yes, so let's, you know, tune in 3 years' time. We'll see if this happened. It happened, B, if it was any good, and C, if we therefore want to see more of it. Because I imagine that if it does come out in 2027, it'd just be the beginning of a run of 4 years. I mean, even down to how would you sequence those films? Who would you put first? It's mad. So that's a good... it's very buoyant, the Beatles news world of late, isn't it?
Well, the violin bass, Paul's first violin bass, has been returned as well.
Yeah.
Which is an incredible story of a stolen instrument that you'd think would have been too hot to handle and perhaps kind of was, which perversely then meant it was actually just left quietly until it could be returned. Not that I'm saying someone was sat on it waiting for it to be...
it would be very uncomfortable to be sitting on a violin bass for all that time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how they've talked about how they've identified that it is the instrument in question.
Yeah.
And that's really worth looking up and reading about it and the chain of how it's got back. So there's been all sorts going on. There's not been all sorts. There's been two or three things and they've been close
together.
Yeah, and big news, really.
Yeah. Well, that's good. It gives us something to talk about anyway.
Yeah, it'd be nice if one of the things was, also we're putting out a Please Please Me box set or something like that, you know.
Yeah. Where are we with that kind of stuff then? Because they've been...
At the moment, nowhere.
Because there was kind of a steady stream of things being remastered and reboxed and things. And in line with anniversaries, have we kind of gone through them all now?
Oh, the anniversary thing slipped totally now. Right. You know, it had anyway. But who knows? I mean, I will mention actually at some point in this my theory on what they should do. But let's get into the episode. Otherwise, it'll be...
Yeah. There's also all the footage from... the guys who followed them around on the American tours as well, isn't there? So that's something. And any more...
Do you mean the first US visit stuff?
Yeah.
which people will have heard Chris Chibnall, in fact, talking about with Chris Shaw on Eggpod recently.
Yeah.
About how many different cuts of that there is and all how extra material there must be, and it'd be lovely to have that.
Yeah.
Delivered to us in a nice comprehensive package.
There's still stuff in that storeroom.
Yeah.
They say there isn't, but there is.
And give us flipping Carnival of Light, and no, do not at me to say it, probably best left behind. I don't need that. I want to hear it. I don't care if you don't. Sorry, everyone.
Well, there we go. And on that bombshell, I love
you all, really.
Let's turn to what we were here to talk about. So it just occurred to me a couple of weeks ago. It's like, oh, did they have album charts? And if they did, what was in them? Is it just the albums of the songs we've been listening to? What gives? It's a slightly different. It's always had a slightly different complexion to the kind of singles chart, hasn't it? And I was just interested.
Oh, totally, yeah.
So I set Paul to task, as is my wont, and he came back with some information about it. Do you want to just start off with generally, Paul? Where's your sources for the album charts? Were they consolidated at this point, or is it a bit like the other ones that we've been doing where it's a bit of this and a bit of that?
So we have a singles chart in the UK from 1952.
Right, okay.
We have an albums chart from 1956.
Okay.
Which is interesting, really, that's the case. But they, you know, same sort of process. And now we have we do have an official albums chart that is sort of gone through the same process of that'll be the source that we use for this, that or the other.
Yeah.
And you are right, though. I mean, I think what's really interesting here is, does what we see in the singles chart, do we see that reflected in the albums chart at all?
Yeah.
So let me do very quickly a little rundown of the end of 1956 to get us up to,
okay, go for it,
more or less where we're going on, right? Because it'll give us a bit of a hint of what's to come.
Yeah.
So starting from the very first one of the official number one UK albums, we have Song for Swingin' Lovers by Frank Sinatra. Then we have the Carousel original soundtrack, Oklahoma original soundtrack, The King and I original soundtrack.
Okay.
We have an album by Bill Haley and his Comets.
Oh.
Called Rock and Roll Stage Show. Okay, so that's a bit different there.
Yeah.
That's our first key to the sort of direction of things. Then we also have, and by the way, these, I'm not saying that this is a definitive list, one dropped and one the other, they often pop back in and out, these things, a lot, more than singles tend to. We have Elvis's album that's called Elvis Presley in America, but over here was called Rock and Roll.
Right.
We have the soundtrack to High Society. We have This Is Sinatra by Frank Sinatra. We have Love Is the Thing by Nat King Cole. We have the Tommy Steele, sort of one of our first wave of British rock and rollers, doing the soundtrack to the Tommy Steele story.
Right.
On the subject of biopics. That's a biopic made at the time that the subject is alive and still famous, and he plays himself.
Right. That's interesting.
Then we have Elvis again, but this time it's the soundtrack to his film Loving You.
Okay.
We have A Swingin' Affair with Frank Sinatra. We have the soundtrack to the film, to the musical Pal Joey. Soundtrack to The Duke Wore Jeans. Then we have Elvis doing the soundtrack to King Creole. Then we have South Pacific, the original soundtrack.
And was that bringing us into 1960?
Well, yeah. So do you want to get started on the list?
Well,
then?
Yeah. So let me just take a wild stab in the dark here. We're going to be seeing a lot of soundtracks.
Now, yeah,
is the context to this that albums are so much more expensive than singles that the kind of people buying them are more likely to be perhaps more mature moviegoers than they are?
I think there there's obviously always going to be a bit of an economic factor in this. And things that weren't pop in Bunny Ears exclamation quote marks, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Were slightly more expensive again. Okay. So classical was more expensive than pop albums. I think that's probably where soundtrack things lay as well. But I don't know. I mean, part of me thinks the reason the soundtracks are so popular is it's because you go and see a film, right?
Yeah.
And it's a big musical thing like South Pacific, which got quite a lot of terrible reviews at the time. But you're never going to be able to buy that. Video doesn't exist. There's no home media. You're not necessarily going to ever see this on telly. You can't rely on thinking, well, it'll be on TV in a couple of years. So what do you do? Your souvenir to yourself, if you like the thing, the soundtrack album.
Yeah, you hear a song on it, and it's not the kind of, I suppose they they wouldn't be playing musical songs on the radio much, I guess, because they're not...
I'm sure they would have been doing quite a few of these, but these albums that are like big movie musicals, which are mostly adaptations of Broadway shows,
yeah,
they're all sort of how to put it really. I mean, they're long things, aren't they? You know, you do 2 or 3 hours in the cinema.
Yeah,
it's not like a pop single where you hear it on the radio and someone goes, "This is this artist right now," and it's just this.
Yeah,
because no one really cared about albums then. You know, there's always this talk of, well, an album was just a collection of singles.
Yeah.
Or it was just some extra product to bolster the artist's income. And that's kind of true, but the soundtrack albums, I think, occupy a different space.
The market is for them at the moment. The pop artists, well, we'll see as we get into, tell us what 1960s were, and then we'll map them, if we can, to what we've been talking about with singles.
Okay, so the first number one album of the 1960s is also the number one album of 1958 and 59.
Yeah.
In fact, it spends all of... Well, it's not 1958. It reaches number one on the 8th of November 1958. And it's the South Pacific soundtrack.
I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. And send him on his way. Get the picture? I'm gonna wave that man right out.
And it spends all of 1959 as the number one album.
That's the thing that's mad. All of 1959.
Yeah.
Every single...
And it spends most of 1960 and most of 1961.
So every single
the number
week,
one.
A steady enough amount of people were simply buying that album more than anything else.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is out on RCA Victor, South Pacific. It spends more weeks at number one than any other album has in the UK ever.
Blimey.
So it's mad. I've never seen South Pacific.
No, neither have I. The only song I know anything about South Pacific is Washing That Man Right Out of My Hair.
I think you probably know a couple more of them.
Well, I might do. But
yeah, I've got the charts data in front of me for South Pacific, which is from the official charts, where it shows you what position it occupied. And it sort of gets in the charts and goes straight in at like number two. And it's like number two, number two, number two, number two, number three, number four, number four, number four, number five, number five, number five, number four. One, 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 one. And it just goes on like that. And at one point it goes two. Then it goes one, 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 two.
Someone accidentally bought the wrong album that week.
Yeah.
Oh no, I meant South Pacific. Oh, there we go.
Oh yeah.
North Atlantic.
North Atlantic.
What is it? Why? What is that about then?
But then I've also got a graph showing its position. It was, and I'm going to go and I have to stare at my screen now because I've made
it. Not great
for
podcast graphs, Paul. I mean, I'm a data analyst.
It's for me. It doesn't stop in the charts until 1972.
Blimey. Why? What is that about?
It's insane, isn't it?
Is it? I mean, I'm intrigued now.
So the film premieres in London on the 21st of April 1958. So very quickly you see the album, you know, is released to capitalise on that. And
yeah.
So you've got Mitzi Gaynor and Ray Walston as the only actors who were in the film who also sang on the soundtrack. Whereas that, you know, it's a bit of a funny thing. It's not like it's just a lift of the soundtrack from the film. It's an album made.
Right, okay.
To go with the film. So they're high quality products, these.
Yeah.
But yeah, you'd know things like Some Enchanted Evening.
Yeah.
You'd know There Is Nothing Like a Dame, Nothing in the World. Oh, that was a bit low.
Didn't know that.
Happy Talk. Younger Than Springtime. These are all quite big numbers that have become, they've very quickly become standards.
Right.
And like say, I think the one I shared was I'm Going to Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair, didn't I?
To be honest, that's still the only one I can really think of, even with those ones you've just said to me. There's Nothing Like a Dame sounds familiar, but I can't.
Well, there's a big Morecambe and Wise routine about it. There's one of the big ones they always show at Christmas, Morecambe and Wise and the newsreaders doing There Is Nothing Like a Dame.
We have to watch it now. Not now.
Yeah.
Not now. That would be terrible podcast etiquette just to nip off and watch a film. But
people do that though, don't they? Watch alongs.
Yeah.
At some point, someone's going to force us to watch a musical that we both admitted we haven't watched. So,
not The Sound of Music, though. I tried.
Yeah, well, we don't have to worry about that for the moment. But that's the first number one album of 1959-1960.
Okay.
Basically.
Yeah.
But it's not the only one, you know. It's just so it does dip occasionally to let another one in.
Yeah, okay. Right, otherwise yeah, that makes sense.
Otherwise there would never wouldn't be anything else to talk about.
Yeah.
And the next one that comes along is The Explosive Freddy Cannon.
Explosive Freddy Cannon. So we've not had anyone called Freddy Cannon in our...
No, and we won't. But this spends 1 week. So this pops in on the 12th of March 1960 for 1 week.
Yeah.
And he's an American singer and guitarist, Freddy Cannon, and the Explosive Freddy Cannon, loads of places, which I find baffling... Say this is the first rock and roll record to top the UK charts.
Right.
Okay, so when I read out that list from the 50s, I included an album called Rock and Roll Stage Show by Bill Haley and the Comets and his Comets, and Elvis's album, Rock and Roll.
Which was just called Rock and Roll.
In this country,
that sounds pretty rock and roll to me.
And so unless there's some very specific thing where they're saying, well, Elvis was also rockabilly and country, I don't see it. I think the Elvis album is definitely rock and roll.
Okay.
So I'm not sure on this status of the Explosive Freddy Cannon, but he basically... I don't know anything about Freddy Cannon, which is why I find it fascinating that this was a number one album and is basically being sold historically as the first rock album to top the UK charts.
Hmm. Whilst not having a single out or...
Well, he had singles out, so he had
quite
a big hit with a song called Tallahassee Lassie, which is a great record, but it was only number 17 over here.
Right.
It was a bigger hit in America. The big hit off this album, which was the one I put on the playlist for you, was Way Down Yonder in New Orleans.
Yeah.
But he also had another couple of singles off it. Indiana got to number 42 and California, Here I Come got to number 24. A lot of these are sort of rocked up versions of older songs.
Yeah.
And some of the arrangements are great, but it feels very studio-y. It doesn't feel like a rock and roll record. It feels like... Well, it does. I'll take that back. But it feels like a rock and roll record where they've got an arranger in and said, well, the horns are going to do this. It's not just a guy on a sax who's like worked his way into the band, knows how to find his place and do a solo. It's arranged brass and stuff.
Yeah.
So it feels very studio-y to me.
But why, how did he get popular then? Like,
how did he get popular?
How did he get to be number one on number one album? Where was the publicity happening?
Well, I think is happening here, certainly in America. Okay, he does this. He works up this thing with his band called Tallahassee Lassie, which was based on a song that had lyrics that his mum had written originally.
Right,
but he meets these songwriters.
That's
they
not
work up a
rock
new
rock and roll, is it?
No, it's not. But it's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he works on it, gets it, and turns it into this thing called Tallahassee Lassie, and it does all right, but eventually it gets heard by this guy called Dick Clark. Now, Dick Clark conveniently hosted American Bandstand.
Yeah.
Which was a TV program that ran from like the 50s into almost the 90s, in fact. And Dick Clark also has a stake in Swan Records.
Right.
So he... likes this song, he gets it out. So, funnily enough, Freddy Cannon is the person who appears on American Bandstand more than anyone else. He does like 110 appearances on that program.
Right.
Okay. A show that gets like 40 million viewers a week. And then he comes over here, he has a couple of appearances on sort of our TV shows, the Jack Good program, Boy Meets Girl, in 1959.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're pretty snappy little singles and stuff, but it's very second wave rock and roll. He himself was a big fan of Chuck Berry, but he's not of that group. He's not like, who do you think of? Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Elvis, all that sort of, Carl Perkins, whatever. He's not that. He's the next couple of years along from that.
And he's not a name that you think of, is he?
It hasn't stayed in history, really, in general terms, despite this supposed status as the explosive Freddie Cannon first rock album in the UK. What was also suggested here, I found a reference in a book saying, perhaps more importantly, it was number one in the UK because it was a mid-price album, a real rarity in rock and roll in those days.
But it didn't have
any supporting evidence.
Okay.
But I started looking into this, as I do, because I can't resist a rabbit hole. I was trying to see if I could find an advert that suggested how much it would be.
Yeah.
And I think I found one that said that it was 25 shillings, which is a bit of a strange way to describe money, because obviously there's only 20 shillings in a pound. So why was it not £1 and 5 shillings? But I think it's a bit of a way of, you'd say 25 shillings because it seems strangely like less.
Okay.
You know, it's
a bit, yeah.
But yeah, so 25 shillings would make it cheaper than the average price of a pop album in 1960, which was at £1, 14 shillings and three pence. So that would have made it a few, you know, 10 pence cheaper or something like that, which was not insignificant at the time.
Okay.
So there could be something in this.
Okay. So, yeah. Oh, I can afford that.
Yeah. Where am I going to put my money? You know, am I going to buy three singles off this record or... Oh, well, the record's out now. I'll say, you know, it's... I don't know. It's a factor, probably.
Well, there we go.
Anyway, Freddie Cannon's still with us now, which is good. And I was looking for Beatles links, and I can't find any particularly, except that I mentioned he was on Swan Records.
Yeah.
Swan being one of the record companies that put out a Beatles record before Capitol cottoned on.
Right.
So Swan did quite well as a small record company because they got She Loves You.
Yes.
And as soon as the Beatles hit big with all, you know, through Capitol, EMI, their sales went through the roof.
Brilliant.
For She Loves You.
Yeah.
So they did quite well out of it. And they also issued Sie Liebe Dich and, the other thing, Sweet Georgia Brown. So they put out the Beatles version, or the Tony Sheridan Beatles Sweet Georgia Brown, which was a track on the explosive Freddie Cannon, which sounds very much like the arrangement they do in Hamburg.
Right.
But I cannot find any evidence to suggest that. But yeah, okay. Tony Sheridan definitely knew Freddie Cannon through when he toured in the UK. So.
Right then. Well, there's Freddie Cannon. He's exploded out of nowhere, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Freddie Boom Boom Cannon, as he's known.
So... So the next, you've got a couple more, isn't there, for this year?
Oh, yeah. Elvis is back.
It was a night. Ooh, what a night it was. It really was such a night. The moon was bright. Oh, how bright it was. It really was such a night. The night was alive with stars above. Ooh, when she kissed me, I had to fall in love.
Elvis is back, just his back.
No, Elvis is back, not Elvis is back.
Sorry. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Elvis is back. Yeah,
out on RCA. Reaches number one for 1 week, so he fights through the South Pacific War.
This is mad because he's selling singles by the... He's topping the number one chart for singles that are not aimed at teenagers for 8 weeks at a time. But his album gets in for 1 week and then is knocked back off by South Pacific again.
This is it. Maybe again, it's the economics. It's the teenage market maybe not being able to afford this. And so there's just a one buying spurt.
Yeah, but his songs at the moment aren't for teenagers, are they? They're...
Well, that's what we see it as now.
I guess
But yeah, Elvis is back, as it suggests. This is his post-Time in the Army album.
Yeah.
He records this on the 20th of March and the 3rd of April after he gets back from the army. He's like, he gets back to the States on the 2nd of March. He's discharged officially from the army on the 5th. By the 20th of March, he's in the studio recording most of this album.
Yeah.
Which doesn't have on it the big, big, big singles that we've talked about. But Are You Lonesome Tonight and It's Now or Never are basically from these sessions and are associated.
Yeah. Yeah, because again, we're still in the era, we're in the era, aren't we, where not every, you know, albums don't really represent a kind of, you don't put the singles on the albums, do they? Or at least the Beatles didn't. It wasn't just them who didn't do that.
Well, that's a bit later on. That's sort of their decision, because there was a couple of singles taken from this in the UK, but not until 1964 and 1976.
Blimey.
So I think I played Such a Night, didn't I? I put Such a Night on the playlist.
Yeah.
Which is great. I quite like that as a little ditty. That got to number 13 in 1964.
Right, okay.
But yeah, it's not a bad record, I don't think, given the sort of stresses he was going through trying to work out whether he had a career when he got back from the army. But I'll tell you what. So I mentioned before what I thought the Beatles should be doing with their reissues, right?
Yeah.
With this Elvis album and many of the others, you can buy it in an edition that has 4 discs in it. One disc is the album. The other discs are all of the sessions.
Right.
All the tracks. Now, we're only talking a limited amount of time. You know, it's 2 sessions over a few hours. So it's not like days and days. This isn't Sgt. Pepper. It's not, you know, months and weeks of work.
Yeah.
Where it'd probably be very unfair. You couldn't put that out as an entire session thing, much as I would listen to it. But you can basically buy Elvis's back and get the entire session recording. So every take, you know.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm getting excited.
I'm just excited that every brilliant. Time you say Elvis is back, all I hear is Elvis is back.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh.
Well, there you go. But anyway, that's what we should be... I mean, if you're going to put out Please Please Me, for goodness sake, that's one of the most contained block of recording you've ever had.
Yeah.
Put out everything.
Right.
Put it out.
They've been told. Paul's told you now.
If Elvis can do it, the Beatles can do it.
Okay. And the last one from 1960?
Down Drury Lane to Memory Lane by 101 Strings.
Yeah.
So, what's amazing about this? This was number one for 5 weeks, right?
Okay.
101 Strings is a invention of a guy called David Miller. He was he contracted this orchestra, this German orchestra, to play these easy listening arrangements of things.
Yeah.
And put them out as these 101 Strings albums. It's basically a franchise. Starts it in 1957, goes to 1981, but it sort of still exists conceptually, I think even now, really. 150 albums this organisation or this thing creates.
Right.
And this is the biggest, this is the number one. Oh, it's just the most easy listening of easy listening you can, and I don't mean that in a good way.
No.
For me, anyway, that scraping string sound. But what's amazing is you can't get this album on Apple Music, for instance.
Yeah.
Because it's not got the historical weight of of any importance as an album.
No one cares.
Except for
the 5 weeks of people caring.
Yeah.
In 1960.
Oh, well, and maybe it was on Pi Golden Guinea, which was one of the imprints of the Pi record label, where the albums cost a guinea, which was £1.01, which is cheaper than a usual album.
Ah, so another...
And this is 2 discs as well.
Yeah, another kind of bang for your buck type of album, maybe.
But yeah, this is another one that stays in the charts for ages.
So it's just reworkings of show TV and film and show tunes just covered by strings.
So, yeah, Drury Lane is a reference to the British theatre. And it's also a reference to the song Drury Lane to Broadway, Broadway to the American musical theatre. And so most of it, like, another reason people would have bought this as well is because if you go to side 4, the first track is Some Enchanted Evening from South Pacific.
Oh, God.
Then Getting to Know You from The King and I, and then Fanny from Fanny. Then I Could Have Danced All Night from My Fair Lady.
Right. So it's just, they're just people buying soundtracks again, really, but by a different group of people.
Yeah, but just in a weird screechy string format.
Right then. Well, so we get 4 albums that hit the number one spot over that year, of which one of them actually features someone who actually had singles released. And, well, who had
Freddie Cannon did, but in the period we're talking about, yeah, the only one that's sort of reflective of what we've said is Elvis.
So let's move on to 61 then.
And, getting tired, Gary.
Sorry, could you tell? No, I'm still getting over my cold from last episode.
Yeah.
Moving on to 61.
We start with Elvis again.
Elvis, yeah. Elvis is back. But this time, we've got that combination.
Elvis is back.
Elvis is back. Elvis is back. I've just got the idea. Every time you say it, I have an image of an album cover, which is just Elvis is back, with him just looking over his shoulder at you. Yes, but this one is a combination of Elvis, who you'd expect, and...
A soundtrack,
yeah.
Because it's G.I. Blues. So the first film he makes after he gets back from the army is G.I. Blues, based on his story, yeah. Sort of, but with more little wooden dolls in it. Whereas this story is... I've just been reading in a biography about him, about his time in the army. He did... Flipping heck. I don't doubt that he did everything he was supposed to do in the army, but he obviously led a gilded life.
Right.
You know, he wasn't on a cot in a room with lots and lots of other people. He was, you know, out living with his family in a hotel in Germany. It's just, it's nuts. But anyway, this reaches number one on the 14th of January, 1961. And it has a 22-week run at number one.
Oh, okay.
I mean, a broken run, as all of these ones are. You know, there are other albums that pop in, but it doesn't do badly. You know, it stays in the charts in some form or another for...
So that makes more sense. Yeah.
Quite a while.
Because we've got, you know, he's in our singles chart a lot. And,
yeah.
And a song from this one is in there, isn't there?
Yeah, Wooden Hearts. So yeah.
A bit more kind of conventional as an album. There's a single tie into it.
Yeah.
There's a film. It's just dominating all the various channels it can.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
It's clever marketing, you know, it's cross-platformers, I suppose they'd call it these days. As these things that we're talking about are really the soundtrack things. It's does all right, but I haven't got much more to say about that. It's obvious and very successful.
So what else do we have?
Right, okay. So we have to talk about this because we've decided to do this. But there's at least two things here I don't really want to talk about particularly. And what I'm very pleased to find is that when I went to see, is there any of their music on Apple? I don't know about the other streaming services. There isn't.
Right.
Other than, I think, one Christmas song. How that gets through, I don't know. Because the next album we have to talk about that reaches number one on the 29th of July for 1961 and is there for 9 weeks is The Black and White Minstrel Show by the George Mitchell Minstrels.
Right.
So... this is not the forum to get into talking about this particularly, except to say that The Black and White Minstrels was a ludicrously successful BBC television show and stage act as well.
Yeah.
They started broadcasting a programme called The Black and White Minstrel Show in June 1958. The last one wasn't till July 1978, by which time you would have thought that this nonsense would have been long gone, but it wasn't.
Mm.
Minstrelsy, black and white minstrelsy, all that stuff. You can't talk about the history of popular music without talking about it because it's part of the way that the music crosses areas around the world. It crosses social things in horrible ways.
Yeah.
But it's very, very important. And but that's there's plenty of books and resources people can read about that. If we don't have people like Dan Emmett and the Kentucky Minstrels coming over to the UK, we don't get some of the first wave of popular music coming over here.
Yeah.
But it's white people in blackface.
Yeah.
Playing essentially parody roles of the music that they're hearing from the African enslaved people that have been taken over there and become part of the American thing. The American thing.
Yeah.
And that, but this is a British phenomenon we're talking here, the Black and White Minstrel Show. In the 50s, of people turning up to watch this in their millions on television. This is a program that regularly gets 16 million viewers.
Mm.
And then in 1967, when an organization called CARD, the Campaign Against Racial Discrimination, went to the BBC and said, look, this is wrong.
Yeah.
This is discrimination. The BBC said, basically, oh, no, it's not. This isn't derogatory. This isn't about race. This is about tradition.
Right, I see.
Okay. The last bit of that's true. It is about tradition. But that the other stuff isn't. It was derogatory.
Yeah.
It was about race. And it's unbelievable that they just basically went, "You're wrong," to the people who were affected.
Yeah.
Which is, you know. So I hate the fact that these things are in here, because we've got this album, The Black and White Minstrel Show, which hangs around in the charts till 1964 at one position or another.
Mm-hmm.
Very often in the top, mostly in the top 10 there. And it's basically, it's two sides made up of medleys of tunes, basically four blocks of medleys of tunes on each side. Many of which are great tunes that people will know,
yeah.
But they're being done by people who make a career out of wearing blackface and...
Yeah. Ugh. Now...
So, there you go.
Well, let's move on from that then. Who have we got next?
We've got The Shadows.
Right.
With The Shadows.
So, when was Apache? Well, that was more 61, wasn't it? Or was it 61, or was it?
No, it was the year before.
Year before. But we've had some other Shadows number ones, haven't we? So they're riding high, and their albums are doing the same.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to the number one slot for only 1 week.
Okay.
But, you know, this is the point where we've just done 1961, haven't we?
Yeah.
And the Shadows star... The Shadows star, that just sounds wrong. Some astronomically, Shadow of the Star.
Yeah.
Is shining a bit brighter than Cliff's at this point, mm-hmm. It seems.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have a number one single during 1961.
No. What a shame.
I think I shared Nivram from this one.
Yes, which I recognize.
Which is a tune I've known quite well, I've always quite liked, which obviously Marvin Backwards likes, quite a jazzy little number.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's good. It's just it's the Shadows eponymous album. It's a good representation of the sort of thing they were doing at the time. You know.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
And we did do Contiki recently, didn't we? As well.
Yeah.
And that's a single from these sessions. So.
I thought Nivram's better than Contiki, but yeah.
Oh, I think it probably is. But you know, we weren't choosing the singles, were we?
No. But then talking about Cliff Paul.
Okay.
Talk about Cliff Paul.
Well, he's 21 today, if today is the day that the album 21 Today is released.
Right.
Because it was released on his 21st birthday.
Blimey. Catch me. I've fallen for you. Catch me. I've fallen for you. What was in that kiss you gave me? Never felt like this. Please save me. Catch me in your arms.
And it gets 1 week at the top of the album chart, 4th of November 1961.
Did it have but Happy Birthday to Me on it?
It had Happy Birthday to You on it.
Did it really?
Yeah. Track one is Happy Birthday to You.
Right, okay. I was joking, because it...
No, but it's credited to Cliff Richard and The Shadows.
Yes.
Which I think is important. It's not just Cliff on his own, it's Cliff Richard. It's not Cliff Richard with The Shadows. It's Cliff Richard and The Shadows, because they... are a big name.
They're already,
at this point.
Yeah, they deserve their seat at the table.
Yeah,
of the album name.
And I suspect possibly because Cliff doesn't have any number ones in 1961, it's why The Shadows sort of name is more prominent on this one, I think.
Right.
I have got the list of sort of Cliff's. So the last number one was in 1960 with I Love You. That was the last Cliff number one.
Yeah.
And then his album, his singles in 1961, Theme for a Dream got to number 3, Gee Whiz It's You got to number 4, A Girl Like You got to number 3, With the Girl in Your Arms, When the Girl in Your Arms is the Girl in Your Heart is number 3. So, yeah, it didn't do particularly well, but we will be hearing more from Cliff before too long.
Oh, he's not done that yet then.
No.
He's all good. Well, there we
well
go.
Indeed. And then, well, yeah, the last one is another Black and White Minstrel Show, which is 8 weeks at number one and is the same thing. It's blocks of medleys over a couple of sides of the disc and yeah, rubbish. I do want to mention this. I don't want to end on a downer, but I am going to. Sorry.
Okay.
Lenny Henry, the amazing Lenny Henry.
Yeah.
Was the first black performer to appear on the Black and White Minstrel Show.
Right.
In 1975.
Blimey.
And has basically spent the rest of his life regretting that happening.
Yes.
You know, and feeling confused that his family sort of didn't say to him, don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a lot of obviously very, very difficult sort of feelings about this, and he still does now. So he basically had a manager who had control over everything, and he had got him into this contract, and I can't imagine what that would have been like for him. But basically, yeah, the Black and White Minstrel Show can get in, you know, the biggest bin there is and just vanish forever. And hopefully that'll be the last time we have to speak about any of that rubbish.
Yeah. Well, we'll see in another couple of years worth of episodes time.
Yeah.
But anyway, I suppose we might as well do this kind of exercise again.
It's
been interesting. It's given me some more context to the kind of the musical landscape around at the time. Alongside,
yeah, I think it's doing. Well, I reckon it'll be interesting for 1962 and 1963 as well, particularly.
Yeah.
Before we get into the sort of the dominance of the Beatles.
Well, that's what I'm interested in. Is how much is it going to just be Beatles, 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 or is it? Or is it going to be no? Even though everyone in the world was listening to the Beatles and loved the Beatles, what they actually wanted to listen to was some kind of, I don't know, French horn soloist version of tunes from the 1910s. You know what I mean? Is it going to be something daft like that?
I think you can just assume it's just going to be soundtracks all the way with pop music and rock music struggling to sort of just pop its head up occasionally and go, me, for a little while.
And when
the
compilations start coming in and dominating everything, because that's the way
I mean, even early on, collections of oldies type things happen.
Hmm.
So we shall see.
Right. Well, it did us, didn't it? Did it?
I'm sorry to have had to talk about those horrible things, but they were there and I couldn't pretend they weren't.
There's no point kind of pretending parts of history didn't happen. We covered it. That's that. I did ask on our Twitter if anyone had any questions. I appreciate it was very last minute, but it was so last minute, no one had any questions. So I'm assuming that everything we're doing is perfectly fine and right and that no one has any qualms.
No. Well, everyone was having their tea, probably.
Probably, no. So I only chucked it up as an afterthought. But
delete it, Gary. Delete it. Embarrass myself.
Well, we'll add to the next episode if anyone does see it. Right. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week as we will go head long into 1962.
Yeah.
And we will carry on our quest. Until then, goodbye.
And the best of the Beatles to you.